Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Rajiv S. Khanna for immigration.com, the Law Office of Rajiv S. Khanna, PC. Today is April 12th, 2012. It's a community conference call that we are all attending. This call is being recorded, so if you do not wish to be recorded or you want to keep your particulars confidential, do not participate in the call, or do not speak up, or hide your identity. You can call yourself Tom, Dick, Sam, Harry, I don't care. I think it's a good idea not to give out your real name, but it's up to you. If you feel comfortable doing it, totally your choice. By participating in this call, you have not hired us, you have not become our clients, nor have we agreed to become lawyers, your lawyers. So this is not a call about engagement. This is just a community conference call. That said, I'm going to start on the conference call questions that have already been posted in the forums. Time permitting, I will answer follow-up questions as well as additional questions. First question posted today was, question. Rahul Gopal Joshi says, PERM rules and specifications. Namaste, Rajiv ji. Namaste, Joshi sahab. Bachelor's in engineering, master's degree in information systems from USA. Currently working on H-1B, et cetera, et cetera. Employer is putting together PERM application. Okay. Now, his total of work experience, including Indian work experience, and I take it including current employer, is about 5 years. So his question is, if I don't have 5 years experience, unless I count my current employer's experience, and the job that I was hired for by the employer and the job they are doing the green card for are not more than 50% different, can we make use of the current experience? And the answer is no. In order for you to be able to use the current experience with your employer, the job being offered for green card must be more than 50% different. No questions about that. So not much I can suggest. Excuse me. Also, under Masters Plus 1 experience choice for EB2, does that 1 year experience have to be very, very relevant to the job description? I would say yes, because after all, if you are requiring 1 year experience, it's got to be related to what you do. If you are an IT professional or you're working an IT professional, the fact that you have experience in chemistry probably will not help you unless you are working on software that has to deal with chemistry. Okay, so the answer is yes, the experience should be related. Next question is quite complicated. I am not quite sure I follow it. 4 year and 1 day rule. Well, first of all, let me clarify a couple of things. I'm not sure I understand your situation completely, but here is what I do think I understand. Anything that happened, the marriage and divorce, all of that is irrelevant. Let's focus only on the fact that you moved, after getting your green card, after a couple of years, you moved abroad due to close family illness in 2004. And you used to visit once a year for a couple of weeks. So technically, the government could say you pretty much abandoned your green card. You were not living in USA, you were living abroad. Okay? In 2007, however, you applied for reentry permit. But by the time you got it, you were back, and you were back for good. So since June 2008, you've been living here, and you've spent only a total of 481 days, never more than 1 year. So the question is, well, I'm still confused about this. My question is, will I be eligible for 4 year and 1 day rule? Well, first of all, the 4 year and 1 day rule is applied as follows. Understand what that rule means. If somebody stays outside USA for more than 1 year, two things happen. Their green card is gone, it's over. And even if it were not gone, they would have to start the 5 years for naturalization all over again. So typically, the law requires for naturalization, you must have obtained your green card 5 years ago, and you must physically stay in USA 2.5 years out of the last 5 years. If you stay outside USA for more than 1 year, you have to start your 5 years period all over again. And in those 5 years, you have to be physically inside USA for 2.5 years. Okay? So, this is the normal rule. But if somebody has a reentry permit and they stay outside USA for more than 1 year, two things happen. One, their green card is not automatically gone because they have a reentry permit. And two, instead of having to stay in U or to having to wait 5 years to apply their citizenship, they can wait 4 years and 1 day. Okay. In your case, it does not look like you need to rely upon the 4 year and 1 day rule. Okay. It looks to me that since June 2008, we are now in 2012. Actually, let me rephrase that. You do need that rule. The question is, does it apply to you? Even though you never, I think I now understand your question better. So the question is, can I take advantage of the 4 year, 1 day rule and apply for naturalization? You know, I'm a very practical person. I can sit here and spend 3 hours at $800 an hour looking over the laws on this. Okay? Or I can do it real easy. I can say, you know what? I would suggest that you do take advantage of the 4 year, 1 day rule and apply for naturalization. What can the government say at the most? No, we are not going to give it to you. Then you apply in 2013. So why argue? Why take so much pain over this? Go ahead and file your application once the 4 year and 1 day are over and you have lived in USA 2.5 years. Okay? The physical presence of 2.5 years and 4 year and 1 day, once they are over, go ahead and apply for your naturalization. The most the government can do is they can say, no, the 4 year, 1 day rule does not apply because you did not re-enter using re-entry permit. Now, like I said, I can sit down and read the law and give you the answer. But what's the point? Take a chance. See what happens. Naturalization is not a one-shot deal. Okay? Good luck. Next question is GLAD 2000. H-1B cap for fiscal year 2013. Today is my day for kind of difficult questions. Here's another one that's a little complicated. Completed 6 years on H-1B and renewing on yearly basis based upon labor. Went for stamping, got stuck there. Okay? Have not received any response. Do I have the option of applying for new I-797 for 3 years? And I'm assuming your I-140 is approved because you're asking me that question. So if your I-140 is approved, you do have that option. Am I subject to the quota? That's a tricky question. There is something called remainder rule. First of all, you are not subject to the quota until December 2012. Once you've been physically outside USA for more than 1 year, then you need to look at something called the remainder rule. And I'm not going to go into the details of the remainder rule, but think of it this way. Remainder rule says you can take advantage of not being subject to the quota, but then we will not let you take all of your 6 years. So, let's say in your situation, in December 2012, which is this year, you would have been outside USA for a year or more. Okay? Once 1 year is over, you become subject to the quota again. But the advantage is you get 6 years of H-1 back. You can choose not to be subject to the quota if you only take what is remaining under your current H-1. In your case, whatever extension you can get, that's what remainder rule will apply to, in my opinion. So you could either come back for 1 year without being subject to the quota, even after December 2012, or you could come back for 3, depending upon whether or not your I-140 is approved. or you could become subject to the quota in December 2012 and get 6 years of H-1 back. Okay. I hope this makes sense. It is a little complicated, but that's the way it works. Somebody sent a question to Monica for some reason, just a question. I guess they were not able to post. Actually, I saw that just a question had posted, then deleted. I don't know what happened. So Monica has posted this question. I'm on H-1, I-140 approved, 485 applied in Jan 2012, got EAD, got AP. The company came in and, you know, another company came in and they took over the old company. It's a successor in interest. First of all, normally a successor in interest is required to amend the I-140. Okay. They are required to amend the I-140. But if 485 stays pending for up to for 180 days, then you can take advantage of AC-21 and you don't have to do the I-140 amendment. Okay. At least that's the way I would look at it. USCIS could argue that, no, you should have gotten the I-140 amendment done once the company took over. But I think there's very good argument for AC-21 not requiring I-140 amendment. Okay. Now, the company that took over the other company, the original petitioner, has moved to a new location just 10 miles away in the same – I'm sorry, I have a little bit of heart hiccups, excuse me – in the same – metro statistical area within 10 miles. So the question is, do I need to file H-1 amendment LCA? The answer is you do not need to file H-1 amendment, but you should file LCA amendment. Okay. Now, question number two that he calls is, he says, can I use AC-21 even though 180 days have not yet passed? The answer is no. The answer is no. You can use AC-21 in or about June 2012 when your I-485 would have been pending 180 days. Before that, you cannot use AC-21. Okay. What Mr. Yates said, what you're quoting from the Yates Memorandum of May 2005, what Mr. Yates said is this, and everybody needs to understand this because I think Abhishek, one of the people who was writing to me, and I had asked him to be on the call today. And Abhishek, I'll call on you once I'm finished with these calls. He was also asking me, can I move before 180 days? Well, here's the fun stuff. What Bill Yates said was, we don't care when you moved after the I-140 was approved or even before the I-140 was approved. As long as by the time we get to you, I-485 has been pending 180 days. So it's kind of like a don't ask, don't tell policy. If you receive an RFE from USCIS within 180 days, you could have a problem if you have left the employer. But if you receive an RFE after 180 days, even though you left before 180 days, it's not a problem. Once again, if USCIS knocks at your door after 180 days, 485 pendency, even though you left before the 180 days, it's not a problem. That's what Bill Yates said. Okay. Now, to add a little complication to this, keep in mind, USCIS takes the view, if the I-140 was not approvable when filed, for example, there was fraud, misrepresentation, then AC-21 does not apply. Next question is from Sahani Mahinder. It's Maninder. Says, hi, Rajiv. H-1 initiated in 2005, transferred to employer number 2 in 2006. Employer number 2 started green card perm, I-140 approved, priority date May 2008. H-1 transferred to employer 3, large company, H-1 extended to 2013. Employer 3 started green card, perm approved with EB2, priority date of October 2011. So we've got 2008 EB3 priority date and 2011 EB2 priority date. Priority dates have retrogressed, so I'm assuming I won't get my I-485 approval right now. That is correct. would I need to wait for the May 2008 PD to be concurrent, you mean current again, before I can get the GC? Yes. How does having an EAD change my current employer situation? Am I on H-1 or on EAD? I get asked that question a lot. If somebody has an H-1 and they get an EAD approved, they do not automatically lose their H-1. If you are maintaining your H-1, you stay on H-1, even though the EAD is approved. You fall out of H-1 and come into EAD only when you actively start using your EAD. How do you do that? One example is when you take your EAD and go to your H-1 employer and says, and you say, Mr. Employer, from now on I'll be using my EAD. Please reflect this on my I-9. So they will have to redo your I-9 with the EAD as your employment authorization status. Or if you take a concurrent job, if you start working more than one job, or you open your own company, that's when you fall out of H-1 into the EAD. Okay? How can I travel internationally with an AP between now until I get my GC? Is it advisable? I don't see any problem unless there is something suspicious going on, like an RFE or something. Traveling on AP is not a problem. I read that it is preferred to stay on your H-1. I do. I have actually a couple of blog entries on this. Go to my blogs and read up on it. I like having H-1. Can I change jobs since 485 has been pending for more than 180 days? Yes. Again, go to my blog. Lots of entries on AC-21. How would I know for sure that the PD of May 2008 has been ported over? Call the USCIS customer service. Keep calling until they give you the right information. Any other suggestions? Nothing else that I can think of. Next question is Flying Fishes 87. She's an ex-Tri-Valley student. Question about OPT. What they did was they joined Tri-Valley, then joined another university when Tri-Valley got into trouble. And in the other university, applied for reinstatement. While the reinstatement was pending, they traveled to Mexico and re-entered in September 2011 with a new I-94 and new service. The first question is this entry okay and does it correct all the problems? And the answer is, I don't think so. I think you got incorrect advice. You consulted a lawyer who said it's okay, you're in status. I don't believe so, because the law says if you have been out of status for even one day, all visa stamps on your passport are automatically gone. They are considered to be defunct. You are not supposed to use them. So the fact that you used F-1 visa to re-enter USA in September 2011 could be questioned. Okay? So his question is, or her question is, I want to apply for OPT, and I'm nervous about that getting rejected. Do you think reinstatement denial will affect my OPT? I don't think that is the problem. What are the options I will have if OPT gets denied, H-1? When is the best time to apply for OPT? I believe OPT can be applied, and you can double-check with your DSO. OPT can be applied within 60 days of finishing your last course or 60 days of graduation, either one of them. Okay? Double-check, and I believe it's true, not just within 60 days after your graduation, but even within 60 days after you finish your last course. I personally feel you may be better off with an H-1, but then again, for H-1, also chances are you're going to have to go outside USA for visa stamping if USCIS realizes that you re-entered in September 2011 using a visa which they consider by operation of law to have been voided. Interesting thing is, even USCIS doesn't follow this law because this law is so difficult to implement, so difficult to keep track of what your visa is, when it got denied, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? When it got revoked by operation of law? When did you lose status? Very difficult to keep track of all these things. So I believe H-1 is your best bet. I would stay away from OPT if I were you. Next question is, Oseresta, perm based on a future employment promotion. Let me explain to you something, which I think is where the problem is. It is true that a green card can be applied for a job in the future. So let's say I have 2 years of experience right now. when my green card is applied for, the employer cannot require 5 years of experience, even though by the time I get the green card, I'll have 5 years of experience. It doesn't matter. The experience is locked down. My experience is locked down on the date the perm is filed, and I must be fully qualified for the perm on that date, not at some future date. I think that's your problem. What you're thinking is that by the time I get my green card, I will have the experience, the extra experience, so I can go ahead and file. And the answer is no, you cannot. Okay? Your I-140 will be denied based on the fact that you do not have necessary experience at the time your labor cert was filed. Next question, Manish_13. Received EAD, APN, priority date retrogressed. Story of a lot of people. I-45 is pending. I have job offer from new employer and need to join on May 1st, 2012. Well, you filed on January 17th. On May 1st, 180 days are not over. But that's not a problem because, remember, I just said a few minutes ago, if USCIS doesn't question you, you can join before 180 days. But I caution you, if the old employer revokes your I-140 and you have left before 180 days, I think there's some serious doubt whether you can use AC-21. So the best thing to do is wait 180 days after 45 has been pending. And, of course, I-140 has been approved. Or make sure the employer is not going to revoke the case for such time until 45 has been pending 180 days. Because if they revoke your I-140, there's some doubt whether you can get AC-21. I think you cannot. Or at least USCIS will say that you cannot. Okay. Can the dependent join new employer before 180 days? If there is an RFE on primary, will it affect dependent's 45 application? First of all, dependent has their own EAD. They can do whatever they want. Before 180 days, right now, doesn't matter. What they do has no bearing on the primary's case. Can primary getting an RFE affect the dependent? The answer is depends. If the RFE is something simple, you know, you're missing a birth certificate, no problem. But if the RFE is something that could destroy the case, then of course the dependent, because they are dependent upon the primary, will also lose their case. Can the sponsoring employer create any problem if I change employers using AC-21 both before and after 180 days? I already answered that. Before 180 days, they could. Even if the sponsoring employer does not have any issues, what happens if we receive RFE on employment once I change employers? You provide them a letter showing that you have a similar job. Rahul Gopal Joshi, travel while perm and or I-140 pending. Posting this for another friend, so this is, Joshi Saab has a lot of friends, good to know. He's got a couple of postings here for his friends. I'm currently on H-1B with direct employer. Perm petition has been applied and approval is pending. I want to travel to India for a family function. Is there any problem? Not because the perm is pending. You can travel anywhere your heart desires for perm while the perm is pending or I-140 is pending. Okay. Problem is getting the visa stamp. I have a couple of blog posts. I also have some recordings on this issue. Getting visa stamping is very, very difficult. Talk to your lawyer. Make sure this is a good case for visa stamping before you go. I personally advise people not to travel until their AP is approved and then travel on the AP. Rahul Gopal Joshi has another question for another friend. Adding spouse as perm secondary applicant. Currently on H-1B with a reputed Chicago-based consulting firm. My perm has not yet been applied by my company. They're not ready to start it right now. I like to start it as soon as possible. And hence was planning to add myself as a secondary applicant on my wife's perm application. First of all, there is no such procedure. You don't need to do anything. The question of adding you comes really only at the I-485 stage and marginally at the I-140 stage. At the perm stage, there's no addition required. So sit tight. There's nothing you've got to do. Do you feel that there could be any issues, as I've heard that the secondary applicant has to move to H4 status? Not at all. That's absolute nonsense. Dependent never has to move to H4. You can have independent H1s, H1, L1, H1, F1. There is no requirement for an H4. You can still get each other's green cards, or you can be dependents for each other. Let me rephrase. You can be dependents upon each other for a green card without being dependent on a non-immigrant visa. No problem. Next question is Ashwin Book. My H-1B transfer from employer to A to B has been denied because of the client letter not being there. Not sure if employer A has canceled the previous H-1B. B is filing a motion. Be careful. Filing a motion gives you no status. On the date your H-1B was denied, you may have started accruing unlawful presence. 180 days of unlawful presence will bar you from entering USA for 3 years. Please speak with your employer, with your lawyer, carefully about unlawful presence issue. I am filing new H-1B with employer C. Same problem. Talk with employer C's lawyers also. Unlawful presence is a big no-no. Passport stamp is still valid. Doesn't matter. H-1B visa stamp does not help you. If employer C's H-1B is approved and directed to consular processing, can I just exit USA and come back? I don't know. Because, like I said earlier in this conference call, if you've been out of status for even one day, which you are, the moment your H-1 is denied, you're out of status. Okay, can you use that visa? I don't know. I don't think you can. If you look at the strict letter of the law, you should not be able to use that visa. That visa is gone. Question two, while applying for H-1B through employer C, is there a provision in 129 which allows us to select a POE, port of entry, rather than OPT for consular processing? Oh, wait a minute. To enter through a port of entry, you've got to have a visa. We are still talking about the visa, so I don't even know if you have a visa at that time. Question number three. If question number two is not possible, can I go to Canada or Mexico for stamping? Well, there is also a law in the books that says if you have been out of status for even one day, third country consulates that are not your own home country or country of permanent residence, can refuse to take your application unless you have a very good reason for being out of status. As a practical matter, people are going to Canada and Mexico, and they are getting stamped in your situation. So my advice would be plan for Canada or Mexico, but pack your bags for your home country. They can decline to take your application. You would have to fly to your home country from there. Anjan Singh wants to know, if a person has maintained physical presence of 2.5 years and they leave USA for more than 6 months and less than 1 year in a visit, is the continuous residency maintained? Yes, but you've got to have a good explanation why you left for so long. This rule is not confusing. The rule says this. Let me explain to you. In order for you to naturalize, you've got to have had your green card for 5 years. Number one requirement. Number two requirement. In the 5 years immediately preceding the date you apply for naturalization, you must have physically lived in USA for 2.5 years. The 2.5 years that you did not live in USA, the following rules apply. If you were outside USA for 1 year or more, your green card is gone and your naturalization starts all over again. If your green card is maintained by some hook or crook, you still have to do 5 years all over again now. So 1 year's stay outside USA creates problems for naturalization as well as green card. That's one extreme. The other extreme, less than 6 months outside USA at one time is usually no problem. The time between 6 months and 1 year outside USA must be explained to the satisfaction of the consulate. To the satisfaction of the USCIS. What are they looking for? They're looking to make sure that you did not abandon your residence. You did not pack your bags and leave USA for good, even though later on you change your mind. Okay? Ramesh Raju 11 wants to know, I-485 pre-adjudication. 485 was filed, priority date is not current, USCIS pre-adjudicates the application. how would someone know whether the application is pre-adjudicated? I actually have a blog entry on this, and the answer is you cannot. You can try calling the customer service, see if they can give you any information on that. Will LUD be updated if you register an application with USCIS online system? And the answer is I do not know. I don't believe so. Okay. I hope that in the near future they start updating the updates to show that the case has been pre-adjudicated. That would be nice. But right now, I don't think they do. People see, I-485 filed in the current status shows the file transfer to local office. Transfer to local office can be routine, or it can be if they suspect fraud or there's some investigation going. There can be several reasons for it. What does the status mean? Well, it means that it could just be a routine transfer, or it could be, usually it does involve personal interview, or it can involve some problem with fraud or some investigation. Okay. Do I need to worry about the interview process? Most of these interviews tend to be very routine. I agree with your lawyers. But, you know, I don't know all the details. Most of them tend to be very routine. We will get it, 2007 says. Last month I applied for I-485 for my wife and da-da-da, and the wife received an RFE saying, prove that you have maintained non-immigrant status. Look, your facts are kind of long and complicated, Vishal. Let me tell you what the bottom lines are. First of all, look to the last exit and entry back into U.S. before 485 filing. So if you filed your 485 in March 2012, which you did, look back on the last entry, okay? So just before filing the 485, when was the last time she went outside U.S. and came back? Between that point and filing of the 485, if she has not been out of status for 180 days, you have nothing to worry about on this account. Between the last entry and filing the 485, not out of status for 180 days or more, we are fine. Now, then we look back upon her entire life history and see, has she ever been unlawfully present? In your case, one of the things I would look for is expiration of the I-94. Has she ever been unlawfully present for more than 180 days? And it doesn't look like she has been, but, you know, these facts need to be double-checked with your lawyers. If she has never in her life been unlawfully present for 180 days or more, she has nothing to worry about. If she was unlawfully present for 150 days at one point, no problem. Okay. Now, one thing I'm not sure about, I don't remember off the top of my head, do they aggregate periods of unlawful presence during various visits? I don't remember what the law on this is. You know, for example, let's say during one visit I was unlawfully present for 110 days, another visit I was unlawfully present for 50 days, another visit I was unlawfully present for 30 days. Does that subject me to the three-year bar? I don't think so, but I don't remember the law off the top of my head. And I am too experienced a practitioner to give opinions without making 100% sure. So the only thing you need to worry about is whether the rules on unlawful presence allow the government to combine unlawful presences during various visits. I don't think they do. I would be surprised if they do. But let's double check that. If all these three things are in order, you should not have any problem. You have maintained status. There is no problem with that. Okay. Your case is separate from your wife's case. Her case doesn't affect you. Okay. So how should you respond to USCIS? You need to get together with your lawyers. I cannot tell you what to say. You've got to get together with them and decide what your particular situation is. I can only tell you generally what the law is. Next question is Carol N.A. Parent, or Sham, actually. Perm was denied because the 9089 did not contain certain terms, or I'm sorry, the 9089 contained terms that were not mentioned in the, give me 1 second. Background check and drug test wasn't mentioned in the ETA 9089. Okay. So, is it safe to apply PERM for the same employer? Yes, because the ground of denial is something really, in my view, very artificial. But as we are all figuring out, PERM is a very unforgiving process. Anybody can make mistakes. Your lawyer can make a mistake. We can make mistakes. We've made a couple of mistakes in the last 15, 20 years. So mistakes can happen. We are all human beings. Nobody can be perfect. Just because the case has been denied once does not mean it will get denied again, because the ground for denial is rather insignificant in terms of the merits. Okay. I don't see any risk. I don't see why you should have to go to another employer. For Oscar, my problem is I think you really need to get a lawyer. First of all, you have such long fact patterns, it's impossible for me to focus on what you want from me. We have a little bit of a time constraint when we talk in community conference calls. I do my best, but I do have to deal with everybody's questions. So, I really cannot deal with all the issues. I think you should get a lawyer, because the consulate is now asking you for things like providers, for example, a job letter. They're not allowed to ask you for a job letter. They can ask you for things like, how do you intend to support yourself? They can ask you for things like that, but they cannot directly ask you for necessarily a job. Okay. Let me see if I can answer anything here. Relative or friends can provide invitation letters. That won't help you. Resume, that's fine. Research is fine. Position is fine. Detailed statement of the purpose of your visit. You want to live and work in the USA. That's the purpose. But I think you should really get yourself a lawyer. Itinerary, funding. You should look at the form I-864. And read the instructions. I'll give you some idea of what kind of funding is required. Okay, I-864 is not directly applicable, but it'll give you some idea of what you can show the government to prove that you can survive with your own means. Okay. I do believe that you should get yourself a lawyer. This is not something you can handle yourself, in my opinion. It's a fairly complex set of questions. It's not that the questions are difficult. It's just that the legal principles that apply to these questions can be complicated. Okay. Now, folks, I am done with the questions that were posted for me. I'm going to first open the call for those people who have posted their questions. So if you have additional follow-ups on what you have posted, press 5-star, 5-star on your phone. Press 5-star. One hand is up. Okay. Two hands are up. Three hands are up. Let's start with area code 608. Go ahead, please.
Namaste, Rajiv ji. This is Rahul Joshi, the real Rahul Joshi.
Aaj jaalo Joshi sahab, kaise hain aap?
Bas ek last follow-up question jo mere post mein bhi tha. So can the requirement for the master's level education be a part of the job description for PERM?
I'm not sure I understand that question.
Basically, when you file the job description for the PERM thingy, can the job description say that this job requires a master's level education in that field?
The PERM forms have specific areas in which you put that information.
Okay.
to repeat that in the job description is redundant, but not illegal.
Okay. But you can say it in the firm that this does
That's
require...
That's exactly what I said. It's redundant, but it's not illegal.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Good luck, sir.
Thank you, sir.
I'm having some technical issues here, guys. Give me a second. Okay. Area code 617. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Hi, Rajiv. I posted the question with just a question handle. This is regarding the company acquired, and like I have 45 pending for less than 180 days. You suggested that a 140 amendment is required. Now, the question is like, can it be done if there is an RFE?
If you get an RFE on the 485?
485, yeah. I mean, 140 is already approved, actually.
Okay, okay. Well, here is the weird situation. Here's what I worry about. You see, the more years you spend in law, the less certain you are of certain things. A person should be only as certain as he should be and no more. Okay, so here is the uncertainty that I have. If you ask somebody who is perhaps fewer years in the profession and has seen fewer things than I have, they would say, you know what, once 180 days are over, the government cannot challenge the fact that you did not make an amendment. Okay, but here is my concern. My concern is, if there was a sharp USCIS officer, they could say, it's fine that once 180 days are over, you are entitled to AC-21, even if you left the employer and joined another employer. Okay? But it's equally true that the law requires a successor in interest to amend the I-140. And if the I-140 is not amended, we won't let you port off it. I think it's a very weak argument from the government. I think it's you're just fine not amending the I-140 and using AC-21 instead. But I worry about those little things.
Yeah, the problem is like the company attorney says that, okay, no amendment is required. So, I mean, I cannot insist much.
I disagree with him to the extent that no amendment is required, but I would agree with him to the extent that after 180 days are passed, the need for amendment is highly diluted.
Okay, and the second question is regarding the H-1. I mean, you said that we need an LCA but not an H-1 amendment. Now, if I go outside, is an H-1, a new H-1 required for stamping? Or, like, I can travel on AP and can I get a new H-1 at that point? I mean, can I apply a new H-1?
Please don't apply for a visa. Just travel on your AP.
Okay, and then after returning, I can apply for an H-1, right?
Yes, you can still be on H-1. If you read the Cronin Memorandum, it clearly says...
Oh, which memorandum is that one? Can it?
Cronin. C as in Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
R-O.
Yeah.
N as in Nancy. I, mm-hmm. N as in Nancy. Do this. Do a search for Cronin,
okay,
in my blogs. If
okay.
You do an advanced search and search for the entire text, just look for the word Cronin.
Okay.
I have posted the memo somewhere.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Thank you.
Area code 773. Area code 773. I take it as Atlanta.
Hi. No, this is actually Chicago.
Okay. Hi, Shaka.
So my question. Yeah, my question was actually posted by Rahul Joshi. I'm one of his friends.
I thought that maybe he was just making his friends up. I guess you are.
No. We actually are having some login issues with the blog. So my question is like, what are the travel? So there are basically three stages for the whole perm process, and what are the travel restrictions on these at these various stages? Like,
okay, let me give you a nutshell.
Okay.
No problem traveling when I-140 pending. No problem traveling when perm pending.
Okay.
No problem traveling when 485 pending if either you have advanced parole or H-1 visa.
Either have what or H-1 visa?
Advanced parole or H-1 visa.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Only time you have a problem is when 485 is pending and you neither have H-1 visa nor advanced parole.
Okay. Okay, cool. Thanks.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Area code 732, New Jersey.
Hi. My question is on one of the statements. Can you hear me properly?
I can hear you just fine.
Yeah, okay. So my question is on one of the statements that was given in DOS for this bulletin, that the visa numbers won't be available till October 2012. So what exactly does it mean that the visa numbers are not available? Does that mean no green card would be given to anyone till October 1st?
Let me explain to you in 2 minutes how it actually works, the nitty-gritty details. Once you file your 485, you get your fingerprints in. USCIS sends it for background check. They want to make sure you've not been robbing banks and you're not a terrorist. Once they clear that up,
Can you be a bit louder? I can't hear you. A bit louder, please.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, it's better. Thank
Actually,
you.
The reason you can't hear me is because I'm technically lying down. I'm supposed to have the flu. So, I have a headset on, but it keeps slipping up. It's not meant for people to lie down in bed and talk. Actually, my team was saying you should just reschedule the community conference call. I said I couldn't do it last fortnight also. I don't want to skip the call. I want to talk with everybody. So that's why I'm here. So bear with me. Sometimes I will sneeze, and sometimes I'll cough, and sometimes my voice will drown. Just feel free to let me know when you cannot hear me. That's why I keep asking, can you hear me? Okay,
thanks a lot. Even if you're not well, you're answering our questions. Thank you.
Well, I'm just pampering myself a little bit. I'm actually quite okay. Just a little touch of cold, not a big deal. So let's see how this process works. Your fingerprint went in. Your 485 is pending. Now your security clearance has come. Okay. USCIS officer sits down, goes over your file, looks over everything. Oh, yeah, everything is fine. They have pre-adjudicated the case. That means your case is good to go. All USCIS formalities are complete. Now what do? They send an email or a fax to the U.S. State Department that, Mr. State Department, this case is ready. Can you please give us a visa number?
Okay.
And if State Department does not have visa number, they can say, oops, sorry, the bag is empty.
Okay.
Then your case will be put on wait until visa numbers become available again. If I remember correctly, State Department said after March 23rd, we have no visa numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That means even though during the other remaining 7-8 days of March, USCIS will keep accepting the applications, they're not going to be able to give anybody visa numbers.
Okay.
The visa numbers.
So for the applications they already accepted, how about them? Even for them, they won't be able to?
They'll just sit on them. They won't do anything. They have two choices. Either they can just not do anything on the cases, or they can pre-adjudicate them, which basically means, all right, visa number is not available. At least we should do some work.
Mm-hmm.
We should at least approve the case as far as our formalities are concerned and keep it pending. Then as soon as visa numbers become available, all we have to do is send a fax or an email, get a visa number, case is approved.
Okay.
That's pre-adjudication.
So basically, you're saying whoever has already applied and 485 is pending, there is no way till October 1 they would get their green card. Is that true?
The only way they would get their green card before October 1st is if their case has been adjudicated and visa number applied for and obtained before March 23rd.
Okay. So is there any way to know that, or it's just on discretion of DOS whenever they send an email, we won't know?
I don't know of any way to know that. You can try calling customer service. I doubt very much they will have that information. So I don't
Okay, so another thing I want to know is now, okay, assume that, you know, visa number was not allocated to my case, then do they still, you know, they may keep processing the case, as you mentioned, and come up with an RFE? Is that a possibility before October 1?
They can. Yes, I believe they can. As far as I understand their procedures, now remember one thing, USCIS is full of surprises. This is one agency that does not like to do things transparently. So as far as we can tell from whatever they have published, it appears that they can continue working on the case, and of course, as a part of that working, they could issue an RFE even before October 1st.
Okay, so my case right now is I have an EAD and AP, and we applied 485 in January, on January 17th. So so before July 17, my 180 days are not going to be over. So my question is, if I do take the risk of joining a new employer, and I do get you know, some inquiry from USCIS saying employment verification or something, so how bad can it, like, how risky is that? Is the green card going to be totally over, or what happens then?
Ma'am, you have to give me some room to talk. My problem is I can't get a word in. So just, you know, take a little breath when you're talking so that I can get a word in as well. Let me address the two issues of risk if you leave before 180 days. One of them I've already covered. What if your old employer revokes your I-140? Okay. There is certainly something to be said. It could be that USCIS could then say that you're not entitled to your AC-21. And the second risk is, if the RFE comes within 180 days and the response is due within 180 days, I think you could lose your green card altogether.
Okay.
Those are the two risks.
So is that the same for my dependent application as well?
Dependent can do whatever they want. They can own a company. They can take any job they want. They can do whatever they want. They don't have the same constraint as you do.
No, I mean, in case of my RFE regarding employment within 180 days, if something goes wrong with my case, you know, they find out, okay, I changed the employer and my, you know, whole application is rejected.
Absolutely. There is a problem. Your dependent is riding on your application. Your application falls, your dependent falls.
Okay.
They do not have any independent application merit-wise.
Okay, so how about if the RFE is regarding my personal things,
I have to go on and take other questions. I'll put you on hold. If there's enough time remaining, I'll get back with you, okay?
Okay, well, thanks a lot. I think you really clarified all our doubts, but thank you.
I've got a couple of other people who are waiting, so let me get on with them.
Yeah.
Okay? Good luck.
Okay.
Okay. Area code 312. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajivji. This is Alok. I'm again friend of Rahul Joshi. How are you?
Hey, two friends. Wow. Okay. I honestly thought he was making it up.
He's a popular guy.
I can see that.
Yeah. So my question is with regards to adding these spouts to the application.
Yep.
And just to clarify, the situation is that the primary applicant's H-1B status reaches the six-year limit, and then that person is on the one-year extension for H-1, and at the same time, the spouse's H-1 also reaches the six-year limit. Is it true that the secondary applicant cannot extend the H-1B on a yearly basis, and he has to transfer, or the spouse has to transfer to a dependent?
Let me understand your question. Give me one second.
Yes.
Question is this. husband and wife. Husband has filed his green card, wife has not. Both mm-hmm. their 6 years of H-1 expire. Can wife mm-hmm. get H-1 extension based upon husband's pending application?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
No.
Okay.
Simple answer, no.
But in that case, will the wife lose the employment status?
She will lose employment. She has to go on H-4 or F-1 or something else, but not H-1.
Okay. Okay. But is there any other EAD or any kind of procedure that has to be followed?
She has to file her own green card.
Okay, but if the wife has been added as a secondary applicant to the husband's green card application, will that make any change to her situation?
No, it does not. She cannot get H-1 extension except if her own green card is pending. But she can get EAD if you get to that stage. Otherwise, she's got to convert to H-4 or some other status.
Oh, okay. So the bottom line is that there should be a green card application filed separately for the wife as well, just to continue the employment status. Okay. I got it.
That's what we always do. When we have a husband-wife couple both working, I always like to file two applications. And the reason is not only that I'm greedy. I am greedy. I want to make more money. But, yeah, you know, I'm being honest about it. I am greedy. I want to make more money. But actually, it is more important that the two should be protected from every possible angle. There are two reasons for filing two separate applications. One is the ongoing H-1 extension. And the other is you just never know in this environment who's going to lose a job.
Okay.
So you always have two cases going anyway.
Okay.
And that will also make you very popular with your lawyers.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Good luck.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Okay, I have one more question from the queue, and if you guys have any questions, go ahead and press five star. Press 5-star, any questions at all. Okay. Area code 703, my neighborhood. Go ahead, please. Area code 703.
Hi, Rajiv. This is Banu Prasad. Actually, my question is, in the last year, June, I applied for labor premium, perm, and it got audit on the October and applied it. So my question is, it was applied for the EB3 category. If I want to go for EB2, do I need to wait until my labor complete?
You have two options. You can either wait or you can withdraw.
Okay. So, I mean, once I get my labor approved, then I can apply for EB2 with the same employer, or do I need to wait until I complete the I-140?
I would, if I were you, I would wait 180 days after the perm is approved before filing the second application. So you can start work on the second application. Just don't file it until 180 days have passed since the approval of the first application.
Okay. And the second thing is my wife applied for labor in the EB2 category, and yesterday she got the audit again. So is there any different EB2 labor and EB3 labor? The time being for audit. I mean, is the same timeline?
No, audit times are the same as far as I know. There is no difference in the audit queue.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's it.
All right. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. I have two more questions in general. So I guess that's it then. Those are the only two we'll be taking. After that, that is the end of it. Area code 781. Go ahead, please. Area code 781. Go ahead, please.
Rajiv, hi. I'm currently on to H-4 visa status, and I had H-1 been passed, and I have an employment offer. And they are ready filing my H-1B, and they want me to start working ASAP. And they've been inquiring about this. Can I start working as soon as the receipt notice of this H-1B is in? Or will I have to wait until the complete?
To the best of my knowledge, you cannot. I'll have to double-check the law on this, but at one point, USCIS was, or at least there was some doubt that if you had ever had an H-1 and then you were on another status and you asked for H-1 again, you could start working as soon as the application filed, sort of like your situation. But I think USCIS went back and said, no, unless you are holding an H-1, we won't let you start work with the receipt.
So does that mean I'll have to wait until the approval comes in?
And to the best of my knowledge, yes, but don't quote me on this since I haven't double-checked it. Off the top of my head, I would say, yes, that is the law. You cannot start until the approval comes. Okay?
All right. And somebody was telling me about this AC-21 thing, and they said that rule doesn't specify you can work or you cannot work. There is no eligibility specified as such. And moreover, your company, if it's e-verified, they can do this e-verification, and that would state itself if you are authorized to work or not after the receipt notice is in. Will that be so?
Okay. Well, first of all, we have just talked about three or four different things.
Mm-hmm.
None of this is relevant. Don't focus on any of this. None of this really applies to you.
Okay.
Only question.
Oh.
I am not on H-1 now, but I used to be on it in the past. If I now file an H-1 application, H-4 to H-1 change of status, can I start working with the receipt? And the answer is probably not. As far as I know, you cannot. That's all you need to know. Forget about this E-Verify. None of this really applies to you.
Okay. And that AC-21, if you had H-1B in the last 6 years, that clause will help me? No.
No. No application.
Oh, okay. Well,
the only thing that helps
I'll have
is
to wait, basically.
Yeah, because if you've had an H-1 and you've not been outside USA physically for a year or more, then you do not become subject to the quota. That's the only advantage you have.
I've not been. I've continuously been in USA.
Okay. Here's the rest of my sentence. That's the only advantage you have. You are not subject to the quota. But do you have the advantage of starting work with the receipt? I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
All right.
No problem. Thank you so much for the sense.
You're welcome. Good luck. Last call, guys. Area code 608. Go ahead, please.
Namaste, Rajiv ji. So this is Rahul Joshi, and I actually produced two of my friends.
I know, Rahul ji. You actually put your money where your mouth was. I thought you were just making it up.
And my question is about the post number 10, which I posted on one of their behalf.
Okay, what was the question?
My question is, in this whole process, I mean, you know, the perm and everything, most likely the H-1 6 years will expire and there will be an one-year extension. So during this process, at any point, if we have to do the stamping while traveling, I think you said that it's not advisable, right? I'm just double-checking.
No, it is not advisable. They are
so which means any kind of stamping you do before your perm gets filed.
That's not the reason. You misunderstand the reason. The reason for the difficulty in the H-1 stamping is not because perm is pending or green card is pending. The difficulty is because consulates are very unreasonably denying or delaying H-1 visas for everybody, especially for those people who are working at client sites.
Right. But this has nothing to do with the perm or I-140 being pending or approved,
absolutely,
but I-485 pending or whatever.
No, it has nothing to do with any of that.
Okay. Okay, because once you lose, for whatever reason, if you don't get the visa stamp, then you are in a big problem because of that, right?
Yep. It becomes a real pain, yes.
Okay, and I have one question about post 11-2, which was my post for another friend.
Okay.
If, in this case, is there a way, for example, me and my spouse both on H-1B and... my spouse is added to my green card application as a secondary applicant. Is there a way to take that spouse out? Let's say if my spouse's company is ready to sponsor the green card at a later period. So that, eventually they are separate. Applications.
The answer is yes.
Okay, so you can always take them out as well as in. I mean,
not
it's not that you can only take it in.
Here is something interesting. So let's say she's got her own 485 pending with you as your dependent. Somewhere along the line, her I-140 gets approved.
Mm-hmm.
She can actually take that I-140 and put that on top of her own 485 that was pending as your dependent.
Okay.
She doesn't have to refile the 485.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Okay.
It can be separate.
Sol, thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Sorry for posting.
Lanjo, you have no problem at all. Okay. Well, one more hand came up, I guess. So this is the very, very last, guys. I am getting tired. So we'll talk again in 2 weeks. I've been talking a lot, okay? Area code 502. Go ahead, please. I'll answer your question.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Hi, Rajiv. I am on H-1B, and my 6 years are maxing out this Saturday. My company has filed a change in status to L-1A, but I got a tough RFE on that. So from past Saturday, what can I have been told that I can stay but not work. Is that correct? Till my
yeah.
L-1A gets approved?
Yes. If your application for a change of status has been timely filed, which it has,
yeah.
you can continue to stay until the case is decided.
Okay, and suppose it gets declined, so the day it gets declined, I have to immediately then leave as soon as I can?
Yes, as soon as you reasonably can, within a few days, you should leave. Because
okay, and if it gets approved, then I can just resume work as soon as I know it is approved?
Absolutely. And by the way, I want to add one more thing. If you are somebody who qualifies for L-1A,
mm-hmm.
Your lawyers should have also filed for EB-1 right away. Because when they file for EB-1, they file for I-485, I-140 together, and you get employment.
Actually, they told me that, you know, let's let the L-1A approve, and then we'll file the EB-1. So that's why I did not
start any work on
EB-1.
They can do it even now.
Okay.
They can do it even now. Because,
okay.
see, under the law, if you have not been out of status for 180 days, you can file 485 anyway. So even if they do it over the next 15, 20 days, it's not a problem.
Okay. So well, if later on, will there any evidence be asked that while this period was going on, did not work and did not get paid?
You get your EAD, then you can work. But don't work till you get your EAD.
Okay. And in my L-1A, actually, Rajiv, just one last thing. They say, you know, I got a very tough RFE, like 2 pages, and
Just two pages?
See, because they have clearly have two sections. One is overseas period, that is meaning India before I came to US. One is US employment, and they've asked very similar questions, reportees and all that. But the period before coming to USA, they've asked prove 1 year of continuous employment. But instead of saying before you came to USA, it says in the 3 years prior to the filing of L-1A application, which is 8/1/2012. So is that a typo?
It's an incorrect statement of the law. You are working for the same group of companies. If you started working with a different group of companies, then the law is correct, what they've asked for.
So it's a typo, right? In the response, we'll have to mention that.
You have to just mention that you are working for the same group of companies.
Okay, and the 1 year continuous employment.
But I have to really, really go. Can you just make it one last question, whatever is the
most important? That 1 year of continuous employment, Rajiv, I actually, before I came to US on H-1, I was for 11 and a half months in India with that company. Before that, I was on B-1 with the same company. And before that also, I was in India with the same company. So can that be,
you have a problem. You may not be able to meet the 1 year deadline. But I don't really know. I'm making a very snap judgment.
Okay. 12 months
have continuous, but short and brief visits to USA should not be a problem. So really, it's something that's very specifically fact-bound. You already have lawyers. They are competent people. If they are, they should be able to advise you, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I'll see you in 2 weeks.